Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Representing a Mentally Ill Client Facing Removal Proceedings. I'm J.J. Area, AILA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Ophelia Calderon from Fairfax, Virginia. Joining Ophelia is Talia Inlander from Los Angeles, California, and Sean Lewis from Nashville, Tennessee. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Ophelia.
Thank you, JJ. Today, we're going to be talking about the challenges that we as attorneys face when representing individuals who have some sort of mental illness or mental health issue while they're in removal proceedings. This has been a topic that has gone through a lot of changes, particularly in recent years. So first, we want to start out with reviewing the landscape of where we are now, where we are with the issue of mental health, and in particular with representation in removal proceedings. We have the most recent case of Matter of MAM, which really explains where EOIR is, or where the immigration courts are, and how we're looking at the case. Sean, can you tell us about what MAM says?
Sure. Great. It's a presidential decision in 50 years to provide with mental disorders. Competency. Yes?
I'm sorry, continue.
The immigration judge must make further inquiry for the court. If there's a lack of sufficient competency, the immigration judge will must also articulate a rational case, also sets forth competent to participate, whether the respondent has a rational and factual understanding of the nature and object of the proceedings, whether she may consult with the attorney or representative if there is one, and has had a reasonable opportunity to examine and present evidence and cross-examine witnesses. I think pretty much that's a matter of MAM.
And what other types of litigation have we seen, Talia?
So MAM is really a case that addresses the competency standard for folks who have representation in immigration court, and the question is really similar to in the criminal context with Dusky versus the United States, is a question of whether somebody has the rational and factual understanding to be able to understand the proceedings and to participate with an attorney present. There's also been litigation to address sort of a related but different question of how to determine whether an individual with a serious mental illness is competent to proceed pro se in immigration proceedings. So what is the standard when you have to figure out not only, you know, is the person able to move forward with the help of an attorney, but what happens when you have a respondent before the immigration court who does not have an attorney? How do you determine whether that person is actually competent to proceed or not? And that litigation was class action litigation in the Ninth Circuit. The case is called Franco Gonzalez v. Holder. It was filed in 2010. It's ongoing litigation, but there is a district court order and a permanent injunction which applies in California, in Arizona, and Washington that sets forth a more robust standard for the immigration courts to determine whether an individual who lacks representation is competent to represent themselves. And it involves the MAM factors that Sean just described. It also requires, in addition to the person being able to meaningfully participate under MAM requires that the individual be able to perform additional functions that are necessary for self-representation. That includes, you know, exercising the rights to object to proceedings, present, examine, and object to evidence, and cross-examine, to make informed decisions about whether to waive the rights, and be able to respond on their own to the allegations and charges. The Franco standard, although it currently, the injunction applies in California, Arizona, and Washington, listeners should be aware that that the government has said that it's going to extend the protections of Franco to the national landscape. So wanted to flag that for folks who are listening in.
In the negotiations over Franco with the government, have they indicated when they think that will occur?
We don't have an exact timeline. We had hoped it would have already occurred, frankly. The court's implementation plan in Franco that set forth this pro se competency standard actually was filed in October of 2014, and we had hoped that we would have some change across the country shortly after that. But we're still waiting. The government has released EOIR has released what's called its Phase One National Guidance, which includes some of the Franco protections, and those are national guidance. So I encourage folks to take a look at that. If you just pop into your Google EOIR national guidance phase one, it will pop up to show the enhanced procedural protections that the courts all across the country are supposed to be providing when dealing with a respondent with a serious mental illness.
And what parts of Franco are included in that phase one? Just like a quick, summary. Is that possible?
Sure. Let me just pull it up. Part of this idea of the pro se competency standards included. So the guidance acknowledges that that when you're talking about a respondent who is going forward pro se, that MAM alone cannot answer the question of whether the person's competent. That you also have to look at somebody's actual abilities. It's not as robust. The types of abilities that the Phase One guidance requires are not quite as robust as those set forth in Franco. But they do sort of explain that. That you need not just a rational and factual understanding as MAM lays out, but you also, if you're going to be representing yourself, need a reasonable ability to engage in certain tasks in order to represent yourself. It also sets forth a process for identifying and determining issues of competency for immigration judges, including a judicial inquiry and a competency review. So that's talked about in the Phase One guidance and sets out some examples of indicia of mental disability for immigration judges to be aware of. So it is definitely worth looking at those.
Well, I guess that really brings us to, I think, our next the next topic, which I was quick to go to that question because I was curious. But of course, the next question has to be for whether or not you're a private practitioner or it's pro se or you're in the nonprofit area is how to identify whether or not this is, and I guess even for judges, right, is how do you identify when there's a mental health issue at play in proceedings? I mean, what exactly is the IJ, what's the inquiry here that we're all doing to make a determination about that?
Yeah, Philia, this is Sean. I'd like to jump in for a second.
Great.
As a private practitioner, we're kind of like at the forefront of the detection phase when the client actually walks in our office. And, the test in, for instance, MAM, the case, talks about the inability to answer questions, stay on topic, whether your client may have a high level of distraction or a history of mental illness. Those are all things that I kind of am trying to detect in the very beginning of the intake phase, because you don't want to find out that these issues are there when you're at trial or you've filed your application. So I think there may be a little different treatment for the private bar as opposed to obviously the court or pro bono counsel or other types of representation.
Oh, I would agree with that, Sean, actually. I mean, as a private practitioner, I know that, I mean, this can come up in different ways. In some situations, the question of mental health or any type of mental competency is something that, even if, that I'm getting from the family members, for example. So there's, I don't want to say it's easy, but, you know, but to some extent, it's a ready-made issue. Like, okay, a family member has indicated to me that their family member is in removal proceedings, and in addition, that the family member has a mental health issue, has a mental health history, which I find, of course, it makes it easier to some extent to gather up the evidence that I need. You know, you and I were on a panel last year, earlier in the year on this, and we had a psychologist present, and that I found really interesting what she had to say about identifying mental health issues in the situation in an intake when it's not immediately represented to you that there's a mental health issue. Do you recollect the kinds of things that she talked about?
I do. I really use the psychologist for hardship, you know, to prove hardship in a cancellation case, or if I'm looking at past persecution in an asylum type case. I really like the client to go to the psychologist because they're going to open up and really tell their story in a way that they might not in a law office with the attorney present. And it's kind of a screening mechanism we also use for these issues. You know, the specific things that the doctor talked about really focus on physical reactions, you know, eye contact, the tone of voice, the little cues that we as attorneys really aren't trained in. I can't remember the specifics, Ophelia, but I think it's
very
important.
No, there were many of them, actually. I mean, she had a lot of them that I hadn't. I recollect it being really, there being a lot of them that, you know, I had not considered either, right? Some things are more obvious.
Yeah.
Also trauma, a lot of discussion about, like, past trauma and recognizing that past trauma could be a clue to potential mental health issues as well.
Definitely.
That's a good point. I just want to jump in and just say for a moment that folks who are working with detained clients may also want to ask their clients if they're taking any kind of medications while they're in detention, and to try to get medical records from jail from the jail or detention center if they're concerned that there may be a mental health issue that the client, you know, isn't or isn't able to disclose. That can sometimes help to suss out if there is in fact an underlying diagnosis or an underlying mental health issue that may be affecting the client's ability to work with you.
Well, let's assume for one second that, I mean, we as the attorneys, whether private or nonprofit, are the ones that have sort of determined that there's a mental health issue and it hasn't come up yet at court. How do we bring it up? How do you bring it up?
That's a good question. I will confess, and I'll just say, I mean, I didn't really plan on talking about this, but I'm facing a motion to reopen where I misinterpreted my client's cues during the representation, and it is just got me floored. And you really don't want to be in that position. You know, there are a lot of cultural misreadings that I took into the case, thinking, oh, this client just doesn't want to bring us the proof. And then I find out later there was a brain injury and other things that the client just would not tell us about. And I don't know why I'm saying this, but it's so important to screen for this issue early on in the representation, I think, as a private practitioner.
I agree. And I think it's also important to understand what you want to get out of presenting the issue to the court. And the answer to that may be different in different cases, right? So it may be that the mental impairment you think is actually not something that's affecting the client's ability to work with you and that you can move forward with it, but that it might be helpful to the court to understand it in order to make a positive discretionary determination. You know, maybe they're getting some kind of mental health care here that they wouldn't be able to get in their home country. So then you might want to, you know, work it in your discretionary presentation, for example, in a cancellation case, or if you're applying for asylum, to show the type of conditions that somebody's going to suffer if they're returned. If though you think that your client's mental illness is so severe that it really is affecting their ability to work with you, and that they may need additional protections or safeguards throughout the proceedings in order to make the proceedings fair, then I think you definitely want to bring it up with the court earlier on to see if there are safeguards, you know, of the type, you know, that that Sean described in matter of MAM that might need to be applied before you can even move forward with applying for relief. So,
well, which brings us to when we raise it in front of the court, you know, when I've raised it in front of the court, like, what's the next step? Like, this evaluation, this is where the IJ is going to inquire as to the competency of the client. How do you go about it? Do you get your own competency evaluation? ICE is required to make one. What do you normally do?
I probably, Ophelia, just jump in, would probably contact the trial attorneys outside of court and see if we can agree on an expert, because I think there's an inherent conflict of interest when you're, you know, going to bring your own expert in and ICE may not agree. And who is your expert? Is that person really independent? I would probably move for a competency hearing after exploring who the expert is going to actually end up being to determine competence and bring the proof and the indicia to the court. What do you think, Ophelia?
I mean, I think it, you know, just I would agree with that. I mean, I think some of this is, I mean, for better or for worse, some of this is about your location and your jurisdiction. I mean, I have to say that, I mean, where I practice, I find that the trial attorneys are aware of this issue. And so, I mean, they tend to be fairly cooperative on this. And so I think that that's a good tool to use. In terms of, you know, outside evidence, you know, I mean, I think we come back to, like, what does it mean to have, to the question of what evidence is being produced and what is it that we're showing, which leads to that question in MAM, which is what is meaningful participation, right? And I think that Talia was also briefly touching on that with respect to that question of, like, okay, well, a mental health issue, what does that mean? You know, how far can you go, and you know, what does it mean to be able to meaningfully participate in your own representation?
Yeah, it seems like it's the difference between, you know, are there safeguards that can help even up the score so that there's a fair hearing, versus maybe this case should just be terminated. This client cannot participate in the proceedings, correct?
Well, I mean, even before that determination, right? I mean, the safeguards come into place once there's been a determination that the person, that the respondent can isn't competent to meaningfully participate in the immigration proceedings, right?
So, well, I think there's kind of two sets of safeguards, actually. I mean, I think the more robust safeguard, certainly, of potential termination or not being able to accept admissions from an incompetent person, only come up once there's been a determination of incompetency. But I do think that there are other safeguards that might be appropriate for people who maybe don't rise to the level of being incompetent, but who nevertheless are impaired and need additional protections in the court. Continuances, for example, or requesting that the respondent's presence be waived if it's difficult for them to come to court, you know, because of their impairment. I mean, those kinds of things, I think, might be something to entertain, even if the client isn't, you know, entirely incompetent to participate.
Okay. Well, I would agree with that as well. Assuming we're looking for the actual competency question, what is the inquiry there for? What does it mean to be able to meaningfully participate? I know, again, on that other panel and from some of the guidance that I've received from EOIR, a lot of it has to do with determining the cognitive, emotional, and behavioral functioning of the respondent, whether or not they're able to respond to the allegations and charges. Mm-hmm. Their ability to exercise their rights and privileges in court, and also to present their own evidence and information. Do you find that in those types of cases, have you found that presenting that evidence has been difficult of their ability to meaningfully participate?
Yeah, I think that having the reasonable ability to, like, I guess, respond to questions relevant to eligibility for relief, if your client really can't do that, I think you're in that territory. Setting aside that, I mean, there's always a difficulty in clients culturally and educationally and even being in court, clients are nervous. I mean, you have to have gotten past the determination that this person's incompetent first. And I think that's, we're back to square one again. Figuring out, I guess once you determine your client's incompetent, I think it changes the game completely from there.
And what, let's assume in this case for our discussion, let's assume that there's a finding of incompetence. What then? What are the safeguards that are in place? And then alternatively, I think, what kind of safeguards should be in place?
Yeah. So a couple of the safeguards that are in place in the, 8 CFR 103.8 little c 2 provides that you can't, the notice to appear can be served on a third party. Talks about the requirements for service of the notice to appear on an incompetent person. So you definitely want to make sure that your client, that your client or a third party has been properly served. If not, that might be a basis for a motion to terminate if there's been improper service. You want to remind the immigration judge if this happens later on in proceedings that there is also a regulation, 8 CFR 1240.10C, which says that the immigration judge cannot accept an admission of removability from an unrepresented respondent. So if that's happened, before you came onto the case, the judge had already taken pleadings. You want to make sure you make clear that those pleadings the judge should not take those pleadings into consideration, and you're going to have to replead your client. So some of those protections are already in place, and then there's sort of the more amorphous safeguard that the INA provides that. That the rights and privileges have to be protected. And so that's, I think, where you have a little bit more leeway to be creative about what, in your case, you want the judge to do in order to try to make the proceedings more fair, whether that's, again, longer continuances or not requiring, as Sean mentioned before, maybe the respondent really can't testify on his or her own behalf and not requiring that in a case where somebody is incompetent.
Mm-hmm. And what about termination? I mean, is termination really the answer every time? That question has been posed to me many times, right? I mean, so let's assume, in a situation where there's a mental a competence issue, that's a debate that I've had as well. With my clients, with my clients' family members, with trial attorneys, is termination the answer? Does that solve all the problems?
Sometimes, I think it can be an answer. I don't think it's always the answer, but I think it can be a good answer, for a client who really is unable to participate and who you really can't work with or can't be able to meaningfully represent because of the impairment. Then I do think that sometimes there is no fair hearing that can occur without, there aren't sufficient safeguards for some people. And I think that that's going to be, but I do think that that's going to be often the rare case. So, for example, I helped a client. I wasn't able to take on the representation because he wasn't even competent enough to be able to really enter into a retainer agreement. But he was deaf and mute and had a cognitive disability, so it was extremely hard to communicate. And that was a case where really, I thought, we went as a friend of the court and said, we really think termination is the only option here. But termination is not necessarily always going to serve your client. If you have a strong case for relief and termination would leave your client without permanent status in the United States and you feel like they can sufficiently work with you or family members can also assist in order to pursue the relief, then it seems to me in some cases you want to try to move forward so long as there are sufficient safeguards in order to get your client legal status.
Well, I think that's certainly the case in cases where, for example, the mental health is also perhaps forming a particular social group for purposes of asylum and withholding. Right. I mean, there are certainly cases out there that have found that there are mental health-based particular social groups here in the 4th, in the 9th.
Yeah. Do you want to just mention the names of some of those cases so folks who are listening can be able to look them up?
I might forget the 7th.
The 4th Circuit case.
The 4th Circuit case is Timu versus Holder, which was from January of 2014. That's a 4th Circuit case. And then the 9th Circuit case, I think, was I'm terrible at pronouncing Russian names, but let's see, Chirkova versus Gonzalez, I think is what that one was. It's a 2005 case. And then there's the 7th Circuit case, right?
Yeah, I've got the Seventh Circuit case. It's also Kolyavsky versus Mukasey. That's a Seventh Circuit case from 2008.
Yeah. And I know there have been cases rejecting it, but I often think that sometimes that's, I mean, I think the cases that have found that it is a particular social group, and I'm sure that they're distinguishable, and that there are times when there's no doubt about that. And even as far as torture, I mean, the treatment of the mentally ill is a significant issue, I think, everywhere. So I would agree with that, that, you know, obviously that determination would not be the answer if this is something that you could fight for and obtain real relief for your client. So not only would they have relief, but they would also have the, with asylum in particular, they would have the ability to obtain the help that they really need as well, right, through other services. We talked about this briefly, I think, amongst ourselves and in preparation for this call, in terms of safeguard or potential safeguards. Something that isn't included is this question of assigning a guardian ad litem to the person found incompetent. Do you have any thoughts about that? I guess I would
kindly
ask Tal. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I think is a question perhaps better directed at Talia, only because obviously if you're in a situation as a private practitioner representing them, your client, you're probably not so much in need of a guardian ad litem. What do you think about that, Talia?
Yeah. Well, you might be right if the client is unable to express their desires and really direct the representation, then you might want a guardian ad litem so you can make sure that you are actually, you know, pursuing your client's best interests and that there's somebody able to articulate those interests. I do think the question of a guardian ad litem is a really tricky one, and that folks should really take a look at the ethical rules in their jurisdictions to determine whether it's appropriate to request a guardian ad litem. I know in California there's been some proposed bar rules suggesting that, you know, requesting a guardian ad litem is taking an action potentially adverse to your client, because you're essentially asking the court to recognize, to allow somebody else to speak for the client. And so I think it's a complex question. But I do think that in some cases and in some jurisdictions, it may be worth doing if your client is really unable to express their desires and direct the representation. Because of course, our job as attorneys is not to do what we think is best for the client, but to do what the client thinks is best for the client and act on the client's desires. And so if they can't state those desires, then finding an appropriate guardian in some cases may be a good way to go.
Well, that complexity, I think, goes to the heart of the challenges, though, also it was to the challenges of representing mentally ill clients, right? I mean, there are that's not the only ethical question, right? I mean, that's one of the ethical questions in terms of representing them and determining, like, what is in their best interest? I mean, how do we determine that? What are the ethical duties? And I think there's more than one ethical quandary or duty, and then the questions that you face when you're representing the mentally ill. Sean, have you had that experience? Do you have any examples?
Sure. I'm thinking of examples where your client is wanting one thing, and you know that that's the wrong thing for the client to want. And, you know, whose drum do you dance to the beat of? You know, do you do what's best for your client's legal interest, or do you do what the client wants to do? And I think that's kind of an open question. So I think of cases like involving minors. We had one where the minor absolutely did not want to live with the sponsor for his SIJ application in juvenile court, and was also in removal proceedings, and wanted to tell the judge, hey, I don't want SIJ because I don't want to live with so-and-so. And you're sitting there going, wow, what do I say to the judge? Again, open question.
Yes, always an open question. Or even like when they're communicating with you, right? Like, how do you figure that out? And I think that it is... And I guess that then that leads to the guardian ad litem question. But I, for example, with the communication issue, I mean, that's a whole other thing, is understanding something that I've experienced when representing in a particular case where today I want this and tomorrow I want A, and then tomorrow I want B, and then the next day I want A again. I mean, this is a real challenge, I think, in determining not only what's best, but what your client actually wants.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is actually trying to get under and figure out, can your client actually tell you what they want, and are they actually able to make a decision about what they want? You know, are they capable of doing that? Is it just that they're, you know, somebody who changes their mind a lot, or is there some kind of underlying impairment that's really impacting their ability to direct the representation? And if it's the latter, then I think figuring out a way to have, you know, to be able to suss that out, what their actual needs are, is really, really important. Otherwise, I think it makes representation difficult, if not in some cases, you know, impossible.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, and then when it becomes impossible, I think that's also an ethical quandary right there, which is, okay, I don't know what to do. I don't know what's best for my client. I don't know if my client needs to apply for a specific, you know, can apply for specific relief. And then in that case, maybe, I guess termination is the way,
yeah.
Right? Because, and so, you know, I have found myself in that position as well. Some that are open-ended questions that we may never, you know, I don't think there's a black and white, like a straightforward answer to.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
No, I don't. And I do think, you know, one thing that is important in these cases that we discussed earlier is if it's possible to try to get a mental health professional involved in the case, not only, you know, to submit a report to the court, but also to help you as an attorney really understand, you know, what's happening with your client, what the best ways to communicate with your client might be, you know, how to understand your communication with your client. I think mental health professionals can be extremely useful for that as well.
Well, I would agree with that as well. I would also raise, just, you know, as one of our last topics for discussion today, how I had a client who was detained, and that was something that was very difficult for me because I needed a mental health professional, and it was very hard for me to get that mental health professional into the facility. That was a real issue. It was a huge issue here. It was a couple of years back, so, I mean, I don't know how. I suspect that I might have an easier job of it right now. Not terribly, but, not so greatly, but it was a real issue because I needed to be able to communicate with my client. I needed to be able to use that mental health professional, and it was hard. I mean, which, you know, when your client is detained, I guess you could start at either place, right? When your client has a mental health issue, and it's already an issue. When they're detained, it's double. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. No question about it.
Absolutely.
No.
Yeah. And there are also other natural kind of barriers to a detained client, whether incompetent or not in detention, because you've got, I call it the rumor mill. You've got so many people with their own cases going on that are going to express their opinion to your client and say, oh, no, you should just do this, or you might have the jailhouse notario, you know, filling out applications. You just have so many other things going on in detention that make your representation that much more difficult. I just wanted to add, you know, that as a challenge as well.
Yeah.
When they're detained, you mean?
Well, I mean, your client's detained and getting bad information from mm-hmm. people that are also going through their own cases, and, you know, and you're trying to hash out, you know, your own case, you know, and trying to assist your client. It's just so hard when they're naturally hearing all this other information, and they just, you know, if they're impaired and they're unable to follow the representation, you're going to have a really hard time, I think.
Are there any, in Franco, is there anything that deals with detention issues and the mentally ill?
Yes, absolutely. The Franco class action is actually specifically for the class members are by definition detained.
Mm-hmm.
So the class is comprised of detainees in California and Arizona and Washington who have a serious mental disability that may impact their ability to represent themselves. So we really focused on detainees specifically for the reasons that both you and Sean mentioned, is that those are the most vulnerable in the population. And so I really encourage, you know, again, even though the class action is only in California, Arizona, and Washington, it really, I think, sort of sets forth a gold standard for how ICE should be screening individuals who enter detention for mental health issues, how they should be identifying them, and how ICE officials should be communicating with the immigration courts when somebody in detention has been identified as having a serious mental health issue. There's a very, very detailed what's called implementation plan order in the Franco Gonzalez case. And it is publicly available on PACER. You can find the case and the implementation plan order is at docket 786. I really encourage folks to take a look because I think it sets the gold standard, and I also think that it can be used even in other places as an advocacy tool for explaining, you know, why what ideally should be happening when individuals with serious mental disabilities are taken into immigration custody.
Well, thank you. I think that we have covered our time and that we've covered as much as we can for this podcast. So I just want to thank you and everyone else for joining us. And this concludes our podcast.